Well, I have some additional sad news. Yep, it's true. Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston got divorced. Shame, isn't it? You know, I was at a restaurant this week having dinner, and I was coming back late from a production event that I had for television. I stopped at a restaurant, and I happened to notice on television they had a station on there. I don't know, it must have been one of those entertainment stations like VH1 or something. You know how they do these presentations. And this one was titled, I think, the Top 50 Hottiest Hotties. The Top 50 Hottiest Married Couples, I guess it was. Because they were married. Many of them were married. I guess some of them weren't, but they were couples. They, at least they were claimed to be couples. And they went through, Elizabeth Taylor on how she had been married. I don't even know if they do have the count on that, but it is multiple times, along with, believe it or not, Halle Berry, who also has been married multiple times. They proceeded to talk about Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe, who rated number 3, by the way. I was surprised. I thought, with the legends surrounding Marilyn Monroe and Joe DiMaggio, I would think maybe they would have been number 1. For those of you who may be interested in who number 1 was, I don't even know who they were. Out of my generation, I didn't know who they were. But at any rate, we have Billy Bob Thornton and Angelina Jolie. I think they were married a few years, and they got divorced. And, of course, we have, the famous or infamous Dennis Rodman and Carmen Electra, who lasted, I think, about 10 days, if that. And I don't know if he was divorced looking like a bride or not, but they showed him in a bride's outfit, which I think should have been left more for the bride because she was obviously prettier than he was in the bride's outfit. But all things to the side, it's interesting that in spite of sometimes what appears to be mockery and what you could say the diminishing value of marriage, the irony of it, and it's almost an oxymoron of what I'm about to share with you, but there is a revived popularity right now going on surrounding marriage. And yet, I say oxymoron because in addition, parallel with that, the divorce rate hasn't gone down. It's still running about 2 out of 3 marriages, a little over 50% of all marriages end in divorce. And you wonder why. Why is this? I mean, what is the problem? Well, it's a multitude of issues. Oftentimes, it surround divorce. But this one fellow, and it was reported in Newsweek, as a matter of fact, it was a husband and wife team. It was called the Lauer Survey. The Lauer Survey. They interviewed about 351 couples who had been married over 15 years. So these were, by social standards, considered to be somewhat successful folks dealing with the matrimonial arrangement and covenant. How many are married longer than 15 years in this room? Just, can I see your hands? Longer than 15 years. Longer than 15. Longer than 20 years. Keep your hands up. Longer than 20 years. Longer than 20. Longer than 25 years. Longer than 25. Oh, boy, we've got some diehards here. How about 28 years? Longer than 28 years? Oh, all right, let's keep them up here. Longer than 28 years, okay. 29 years. Longer than 29 years. Longer than 30 years. Longer than 30 years? Longer than 30 years. Longer than 32 years. Get those calculators going. 32. 33. 33 years? Longer than 34 years. 35 years. 36 years. Wow. 40 years? 39. 38. 37. How about that? Let's give them a hand. Lloyd and Gail Carey, for those of you who couldn't see it on the tape program. 37 years marriage. How about that? Well, congratulations. But at any rate, these couples, and perhaps some of us, and I know I would agree with some of the findings of this particular survey, stated, the question was, what would you attribute some of the characteristics, that are serving to your success? What would you attribute some of those characteristics of importance? How would you describe them? And they said, well, one of them, not necessarily in this order of importance, but one of them would be being friends with your mate. Best friends. Being friends. Also, they said, you have to have the qualities of integrity. There's got to be some integrity associated with both, husband and wife. You have to care. You have to care. And you have to be, guys especially, have to be sensitive. Sensitive. That was important. That was an important thing. And have to have a sense of humor. You've got to be able to laugh at yourself. You can't just be heavy all the time. No fun. No fun. Everything is just a big chore. I don't know what we're going to do today. Boy, is this tough living with you. Who you think it's tough living with me? I see it from my point of view. You know. Got to have fun. You got to be humorous and have a sense of humor. And then, of course, it goes without saying that there has to be a sense of commitment. Now, of course, the question comes in right away. I mean, it came to my mind. Well, how do you achieve these characteristics of importance? What are some of the underscoring, what you could say, important linchpins, connections that one has to make or should make in order to achieve these characteristics of importance? Because these are pretty important characteristics. But they're there. How do you get to them? What feeds these? How do we generate them in our relationships? And there was an author, a guy named David Viscott, who wrote a book, I Love You, Let's Work It Out. That was the title of his book. I Love You, Let's Work It Out. And he claimed in his book that, and I tend to agree with this, that commitment underscores a major, major reason. It is a major ingredient in affording you the opportunity to develop these characteristics, additional characteristics of importance, you see. Without commitment, how are you going to care when one is down or be sensitive? What would motivate you? I mean, with no commitment, you see, you're not motivated to hang in there and do what is important. And unfortunately, today, as you know as well as I do, we're living in a disposable society, brethren. Forget the fact that most people throughout this world, as Lloyd pointed out in his sermonette, don't have a clue on what God is doing on the planet. That's number one. Don't understand the purpose of life. Don't have a clue about the truth about death in life and where you go after you die. I mean, those are major questions that you have answers to, as well as in addition to another answer you have to a major point of confusion that vast majorities of people suffer under. You know what that is? They don't understand the value of marriage. I would hope you as a Christian do, that you understand the tapestry behind marriage, and therein understanding that tapestry and the symbology and the fact that what it is a microcosm of in relationship to a spiritual relationship that God has through Christ and His church, adding the value to this physical association that you share with a female and a male, because that's the original intent. That anything else is mockery, a shame, and an abomination, you see. And that goes without saying. But understanding these values, hopefully we can better appreciate why we should be motivated and committed to doing what needs to be done in order to preserve this covenant relationship that is bound by a vow. That's important stuff. I'm using specific words and terms for you to understand the significance and the importance and the magnitude of the relationship that you take on as husband and wife. Your vow, this isn't a contract. This is not a promise. This is just not something on a humanistic, secular level that is just, you know, able to be broke without consequences. No, it's a covenant. And if it is broken, there will be consequences. There are consequences with divorce. That's another story. All I'm trying to say here, though, is, brethren, that hopefully we as Christians understand the magnitude of when we say what we say in front of God. Forget witnesses. Forget human witnesses. When you go before God and you vow, you put a whole different level of obligation to something that you're saying, whatever you're saying, you see. So, in our unfortunate disposable society, too many of us today in our social system cut and run. And a lot cut and run. I mean, Dennis Rodman and Carmen Electra, 10 days? It's a mockery. You go to Las Vegas, you have a few drinks, you walk into a chapel and say, I do. What was that? You know what I'm saying? And yet, it happens time after time after time, like an old wet dish rag. It's just like an old wet dish rag. Just reduced to virtually nothing. And unfortunately, in today's day and age, we have very limited commitment, or in some cases, no commitment. And we live in a society that seems to corroborate, encourage, or support the fact that, well, you can't get along, life's too short to deal with that, just get rid of her, just get rid of him, you know. You don't need to put up with that, there's many more fish in the sea. You've heard all those cliches and all those things that go on, you know. And yet, it's unfortunate because, really, to appreciate the relationship that marriage is intended to be, it requires, without question, brethren, commitment. It really does. It takes time and effort to develop the skills of patience, communications, the efforts to listen analytically and try to put yourself in their shoes, be it the husband and or the wife, and to patiently listen to them without you thinking about what you're going to say while they're talking, hoping you're listening, that you're not listening because you're too much busy thinking about what you're going to retort with. You see, that in itself is a learned skill over time that hopefully in due time becomes easier with the person because you're with them longer, you see. So you get to hopefully know them a little bit better because marriage, I'll tell you what, it's a ride. It's a ride. It's dynamic. It's forever changing. Guaranteed your first year will be different than your third year. Guaranteed your third year will be different than your fifth year. Guaranteed your fifth year will be different than your tenth year. And your tenth will be different than your 15th. Your 15th will be different than your 20th. I'll guarantee your 20th will be different than your 25th. Do you know why they're different? Because life's dynamic. You're dynamic. You're aging. You're maturing. Your circumstances in life are changing. Maybe you have a change in the job. The job requires you've got to go ahead and move. A decision has to be made. I don't want to move. I'm not moving. My family's here. You know, I'm not moving. But we got to move, honey. I got to promote. We got to... How do you get these conflicts resolved? How do you deal with these things? A child. A child comes in. Now your life changes. It really changes with children. Finances. You could go on. Health. Failures and successes. Hey, we won the lottery. Married? I'm married. All of a sudden, you know, you've got $5 million in your pocket. Wife, what's your name? A husband, what's your name? You know. And we sit here and we smile and we laugh. But the fact is that unfortunately, sometimes success can be someone's worst curse. Happens either way. It doesn't always have to be problems. It doesn't always have to be on the negative side of the ledger. It can be a positive success accomplishment that can bring down a happy marriage. Without question, you see. Lack of children, grandchildren, educational needs, decisions, I mean, brethren, on a variety of issues. And what I'm trying to say here is, when you have two people, I think you'll agree to this, when you have two people, You have two points of view, don't you? You have two opinions. You have two perspectives. When you bring two people together, they have generally two different standards. Why? Because you're not marrying your brothers and sisters. You know, we're marrying somebody that came from a different, maybe even part of the country. You know, maybe we even marry somebody from a different race with a different temperament. You see, and those things happen. Interracial marriages are not sin, spiritual sins. God's statements on all of that was due to his concerns about them going south with other gods. That's what that was all about. So all I'm saying is, when two people come together, we have a lot of differences, a lot of potential potholes that many people can be faced with, and needless to say, and that's what I'm saying, conflicts are going to occur. Conflicts, brethren, in marriage will occur. It isn't holding hands when you were dating and saying, "Isn't this wonderful? I just love you." And we're off and to the races, you know. And it's yada, yada, yada. "Oh, it's so happy. I can't wait. We'll go to the drive. Oh, I can't wait. Let's go to a movie. Oh, I can't wait. Let's go out to eat. Oh, we'll go to the weekend. We'll go to Cedar Point for the weekend. Oh, we're going here. We're going there." Well, we've never had, how many people, I've talked to a lot of people who say, "I've never had an argument with them." Well, I'd say, bing, you know, caution. I used to always tell my girls, spill hot soup on their lap and see what they do. You know, change the dynamics and see what they do. Because life is not a cakewalk. It's not all roses, you see. And in a marriage, in the way marriages occur as years go on, obviously, brethren, conflicts will occur. And as Christians, what I'm saying, brethren, as Christians, we need to be committed. It is a sacred institution to enter into a covenant relationship with someone of the opposite gender. And when one makes that promise, it is an awesome promise because you're entering in to a relationship that is the closest thing that God shares with his human family. Because the commitment God has to resurrect you upon Jesus' return, marriage is the closest thing you can get to understand the magnitude of that commitment that he has on a spiritual level. Therefore, marriage is not for kids. When you understand the depth, the magnitude, the breadth, the scope, the height of what marriage is, it's awesome. Divorce was never intended to be a part of the program. It was devised, authored, and written by Moses, according to your Bible, because of man's inability to get along. For the hardness of your hearts, for your weaknesses. Mark chapter 10. When you enter into marriage, brethren, you enter into marriage with the words of Jesus on your mind. Underscoring marriage is commitment. Commitment like you cannot imagine. Can you imagine if there was the slightest doubt in your mind that God would divorce himself from the promise he made to you personally to resurrect you upon your death? Can you imagine how nervous you would be? You would go to the grave still wondering whether or not he's going to be true to his promise. You see, when you go into marriage, brethren, you've got to be sure, for better or worse, in good health or bad. Because guess what? You could get married, say I do, and lo and behold, she or he goes out, gets slammed into a car accident, and they're paraplegic for the rest of their lives. I've worked in the kidney dialysis community and field, and I can't tell you how many divorces I've seen because one mate came down with kidney disease. And so all of a sudden the husband or the wife deserts and abandons the wife. Doesn't want to deal with the overhead. Doesn't want to deal with the neediness of a dialysis way of life now because the one mate is a dialysis patient hooked to a machine for every 2 to 3 days. It's too much. Don't want to deal with that responsibility. These are real life things, brethren. Are you ready for the magnitude of those kinds of commitments? Jesus says here, being approached, he says in verse 2, the Pharisees come to him, verse 2, Mark 10, and asked him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife, to divorce her, tempting him? They had an ulterior motive here. And he answered, verse 3, and he says unto them, what did Moses tell you? What did he command you? And they said, well, Moses suffered to write a bill of divorcement and put her away. And there's a lot of backdrop to this. I'm not going to digress into that because I don't have the time. But suffice it to say, Jesus wanted to take this kind of head on. So he kind of approaches it here in verse 5 and states something very matter of fact. He says, and he answers unto them, verse 5, Mark 10, he says, for the hardness of your hearts he wrote you this precept. Well, Moses wrote a bill of divorcement. Yeah, he did. For the hardness of your hearts he wrote it. Yeah, go ahead, get divorced. You can. It's there. It's legal. And if you do, it's allowable. But, he says here in verse 6, but, it's there, verse 6, from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female. In Matthew, it talks about from the beginning, it was not so. Why? Because God went into this with the fact that he created Adam and Eve. Monogamous. One wife. One husband, female, male, there's a lot being said here, you know. And he went into this with the statement of the fact that he said it was from the beginning it was not so, that is divorce. Verse 7, for this cause, what cause? When a man finds a woman. When a man finds, you know, I mean that's a good song. That's a good song, there's a lot of soul to that. And it says here, from the beginning of a creation, God made them male and female. Verse 7, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. And the two shall be one flesh. The tapestry. Notice this tapestry, brethren. Overlay. Here's a truth of God's nature. Two becoming one. God is one. And yet, you understand, there's no Trinity. You can understand the nature of God. How does a husband and a wife become one? It's in figurative language that they become one because in the flesh, of course, they can become one. But emotionally, spiritually, mentally, they also become one. That's the poeticness of a matrimonial relationship. It should grow as one, you see. And hopefully, perhaps even as time goes on, unless external circumstances occur, conflicts perhaps can even be reduced because you grow as one. And you come together under similar and parallel purposes. But in verse 8 it says here, two shall be one flesh, so they are no more two but one. What therefore God has joined together. Notice that. That's key to understanding. What God has joined together. When you come before God and you vow before God to take this person as your lawful wedded, you know, husband and or wife, you are making a promise to God, and God is binding that, and he has joined it together. And he says here, let no man put asunder. I'm not going to digress into the rest here at this point, because my purpose here primarily today is on the positive side of the ledger here to illustrate our need for recognizing that, frankly, as Christians, brethren, divorce should not even be in our vocabulary. That's the long and short of it. That really is the long and short of it. And it's far too many times we as Christians get caught up in similar sociological standards, thereby in our own minds attempting to validate certain things that we shouldn't be validating because we as Christians are expected to perform better because of the understandings, as Lloyd pointed out in his sermonette, the understandings we have. even in facing death, God would expect us who understand the truth about death and what the future holds for us to be a little bit different. Yes, I'm not saying we shouldn't mourn the loss of our loved ones. Absolutely. It's natural. It's right. It's good to cry and shed tears over the loss of a child or a wife or a mother, a father, an uncle, a brother, and what have you. I mean, that's natural. That's normal. That's what we as human beings should do. But by the same token, to become dysfunctional, depressed, and neurotic over it, and to go off on, as they say, the deep end over the death of a loved one or something along those lines, and to take it to an extreme that perhaps you would expect someone who doesn't have the same hope for the future is unnecessary. You're putting yourself through an unnecessary exercise of grief because this life is not all there is. And death is just a temporary standby mode for someone to go into. It's kind of like pause on the tape player. Tape still, everything's there. Everything's fine. Everything's fine. It's just a matter of waiting for resume to be pressed. And we pick up where we left off. But we have different bodies. We have good health. We can travel at the speed of thought. We can go through walls. We eat not because we have to, but because we enjoy it and we want to. We'll be with Jesus Christ. We're going to have the opportunity to rule and reign, as Lloyd pointed out in his sermonette, for 1,000 years. And you know what? That's only the beginning. That's just the beginning of this, what is called eternal life and living with God for all eternity. So, I mean, it's a great opportunity. But all I'm trying to say here in this regard, and it's something certainly that all of us need to realize, is that marriage was never intended to be broken once entered into. The original intent of marriage is it is for life. Why? Because it's the closest thing for you to enter into the similar concept that God has in the level and magnitude of commitment He shares with you personally in His assurance for you, you and you and me, to be resurrected. And that same sense of assurance, brethren, should be shared with each mate within that covenant matrimonial relationship. So then, whatever conflicts may come up, and they will come up, conflicts will come up. If there's that sense of commitment, then you ought to be able to be yourself. If you're mad, express yourself being mad or whatever it is, without the fear, of course, of losing one another. But contrary to social standards, divorce should certainly be a last-ditch resort. After all else fails, because it is certainly an option, but unfortunately, it's not relegated to the last resort option that it really ought to be relegated. So all I'm saying is, brethren, is that if we are committed, then we should be able to work it out. And if you haven't got the gist of what I'm talking about a little bit today, what I'm talking about is the resolution of conflict. And part of resolving conflict in our marriages or in any of our relationships, frankly, deals with, number one, being committed to, number one, resolving and or managing the conflict. Because here's the reality. There are conflicts that you may not be able to resolve. But you should be able to manage through it. You should be able to manage through it. And that starts with changing our minds toward viewing conflicts. You know, a long time ago I was told, when I was a regional sales manager, Bill, you don't have problems. You don't have problems. You have challenges. You have challenges. Because I would say, I got this problem over here. I got that problem over here. No. You don't have problems, Bill, as I was told by my national sales manager. You have challenges. And there was an important lesson for me to learn in that. Because when you look at that, there's a sense of hope. Problems seem, you know, sometimes connotates hopelessness. Well, conflict. We have to change our psychology toward conflict, too. We have to look at conflict not as something necessarily bad. Consider it natural. And secondly, consider it as an opportunity for growth. Conflict is an opportunity for growth, and it needs to be considered such. Just because you have a difference of opinion doesn't mean you can't resolve it and manage through it. You know, you think of stories in the Bible. I'm not going to have time to really turn to the stories, but I'll reference them because I think you're familiar with them. The story about Jonathan and David. They had an issue with one another. David thought Saul was out to kill him. Saul was, of course, as many of you know, Jonathan's father. Jonathan didn't agree with David. They had a conflict. Jonathan says, "No, my dad's not after you. He's not going to kill you. He doesn't want you dead." David was adamant. "Yes, absolutely. He wants me dead." So there's this conflict going on. Jonathan won't believe David. David's convinced. And Jonathan can't convince David against his will on his perception, you see. So what do? They just get mad and walk away, break the relationship, say, "Ah, you're nuts. You know, my dad's not going to kill you." They don't. No, what they do is they attempt to manage through the conflict. And we're going to talk a little bit about how they did that here in a minute, but bear with me. The results are obvious. As you read the story, you find out that they both listened to one another, they both talked with each other, and they both made arrangements. They both made arrangements to accommodate the, what you could say, result of trying to resolve this. And what it was with some things with arrows and, you know, making them fly a certain way and a little lad going into a field and chasing the arrows, you know, shooting them beyond and so on. You know the story. I'm not going to belabor a lot of the details. But the point is that after the arrows were shot and the little lad brought them back, Jonathan gave the bow and the arrows back to the little lad, told the lad to go to the city. David, who had been hiding out in the field, waiting to see which sign or signal would occur to determine whether or not indeed Jonathan witnessed Saul's animosity toward David, or whether or not David was wrong in his perceptions about the animosity that Saul had toward him. Turned out that, of course, David was right, Jonathan was wrong. And you can read the story there in 1 Samuel, I think about 20, where they embraced, because after the little lad left with the bow and the arrows, David knew that Jonathan now knows that indeed his father Saul was after David and wanted David dead. And they both embraced and had parting words, and it's quite a story. But they resolved conflict. You can read in Acts 15. There's another conflict. Here you've got modern-day Christians commencing into the city of Jerusalem, and they're all at each other's throats. They've got a lot of differences of opinions. There's a lot of conflict, and the Bible even uses Greek words that are indicative of the fact of arguments and great disputings, large disputes. I mean, these were violent disputes. I mean, they were yelling. They were passionate, you know, is what I'm saying here. And they argued back and forth, "We ought to have them circumcised." "No, you don't need to be circumcised." And Paul and Barnabas, you know, they were digging in, you know. And so they went to Jerusalem to try to resolve this issue. And again, you go down through this whole thing. I'm just talking about principles. I'm not getting into the details, but I want you to understand, recognize the overall principles, because we're going to be talking about that here in a minute. They resolved. They managed through the conflict. And in managing through the conflict, read it, Acts 15, take your time, read it, notice the techniques that were used, how they resolved it, because there are certain, what you could say, obvious observations that you can make as you read down through the dialogue of how they behaved, all those people behaved, to arrive at a consensus of agreement. And there are other stories in your Bible that certainly do provide you with insight. And one of these points of resolving conflict that I want to share with you today, and again, I don't have a lot of time to go into a lot of detail about other areas because there are a variety of points. You could give a whole sermon on just some of the details on how to resolve interpersonal relationships and conflicts associated with those relationships. But this is an underscoring principle, brethren. And that is that you must mutually respect one another. You must mutually respect one another in equality. And what am I talking about? What I'm talking about is the "you're okay, I'm okay" approach. Compared to, bear with me here, I'm not trying to give you any kind of psychology here, but I'm just trying to give you some concepts. Compared to, or versus, "I'm okay, you're not, I have rights, you don't." meaning I'm taking the superior role, it's all your fault, and I'm going to beat you up. And if you don't do it the way I want it, there's the road, you know, the highway. What do they say? Don't do it my way, there's the highway, or some along those lines. You know what I'm saying. Or versus, here's the second option, the inferior approach. You're okay, I'm not, you have rights, I don't, go ahead, whip me. And the other just dominates. The best results, brethren, the best results is mutual respect as an underlying principle when you approach a conflict. When you approach a conflict. Notice over here in Ephesians 5. Ephesians 5 for a minute. I want to read this because I think sometimes we forget the mutual respect that is outlined here from both points. The wives and or the husbands. Verse 22, wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. But, it goes not without saying, husbands, verse 25, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loves his wife loves himself. For no man ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, even as the Lord the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh and of his bone. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall be joined unto his wife. The two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery. But I speak concerning Christ and the church. And that's the underscoring of all of this that's being talked about in relationship, using this, what you could say, physical imagery to illustrate that it is in parallel with and similar in like value to Christ's relationship with his church. However, he says here, nevertheless, verse 33, because he doesn't want to digress into that. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband. So there's a mutual respect here. One goes hand in hand. One is not the dominant over the other in that regard. Yes, the husband is viewed as the head, but that is not a license to dictate or to override and overrule by virtue of power mongering, so to speak. Conflicts in arising, brethren, we need to be aware of when they happen, because they will happen. Watch out, they're going to happen. Conflicts will arise. When they do, understand something. Behavioral responses are going to occur. It just happens. You know, something happens, you drop something, you ran the car into something, you ran something over, one of the children are in trouble, something occurs, you want to buy a leather chair versus a cloth-covered chair, you want to buy a red car versus a green, you know, we could go on and on and on. Point being, though, is that there are a lot of things when things do happen that can happen that'll generate conflict. And when they do, again, two broad behavioral patterns occur. One, or A, we can protect ourselves and act, meaning blame someone else. Defend your position, you know, control, or withdraw, silent treatment. And a lot of that deals with protecting one's self. Secondly, B, the other option you have is to search and discover for understanding. How do you do that? I'm okay, she's okay. I mutually respect her. I mutually respect him. Oh, okay, so why ask questions? Why am I upset? Why am I upset? Forget the blame game. Forget defending yourself. Ask yourself, why are you upset? Or what are my issues? Or why is she or he upset? In other words, ask questions. Put yourself in that other person's shoes. Don't be so self-oriented and self-concerned about your position. Because granted, either way is going to generate different results. You take the defensive role, protect yourself, you're not going to get a whole lot of mileage out of that. You're not going to get a lot of mileage out of that. You've got to understand, brethren, that oftentimes we're dealing with perceptions. We're dealing with things that are what you could say sometimes not necessarily right or wrong in that regard. They're not necessarily bad or good. Case in point, a green car versus a red car. You know, I go into an ice cream store and I buy chocolate ice cream versus my wife buying vanilla ice cream. You know, to choose a leather chair over a cloth chair. You know, there's things sometimes that deal with perceptions, likes, and tastes that are, you know, they're not worth having conflicts over. Now, granted, don't get me wrong, there are things that are wrong. If one's involved in alcoholism, pornography, maybe smoking at home and it's endangering because secondhand smoke, I mean, there's a lot of scientific proof now associated with, you know, secondhand smoke proving the fact that it's not good for those around. And if you care about people, you're not going to involve yourself in this kind of stuff, especially if it's counterproductive to the matrimonial relationship, you know. So, yeah, if alcohol is involved, if pornography is involved, if driving a car too fast when the children are in the car, or being reckless with something, spending your money foolishly, gambling it away, I mean, those things are wrong. And granted, those are issues and conflicts that are indeed black and or white. And for Christians, brethren, we ought to be able to clearly see our way through some of those things, you see. But oftentimes, our conflicts revolve around some things that are rather subjective and consequently are not always necessarily wrong or right, but you're dealing with perceptions. And clarifying those perceptions are what is important for a lot of us in being able to develop the skills to work through the clarifying. And that's where oftentimes, if you're not committed, guess what? The bad gets worse. You get impatient. Because guess what? You revert to defending yourself or blaming, you know, rather than trying to understand and trying to get at identifying the issues. And consequently, it just gets worse. So it's important, brethren, that we understand that if we're going to try to make the best of resolving or managing, I want to make an important distinction between that, because you're not going to always resolve everything. You're not always going to resolve everything. There will be, in some cases, sometimes compromises that have to be made, of which will translate into sacrifices for the one. It happens. That's when you got to manage through it, you see. So sometimes you're not going to always resolve your conflicts, but you must manage through it. Why? Because you're committed, right? We're committed. We're dedicated to the cause. And we are going to work it out because, as the title of the book is, I love you. We can work it out. You see, that's important for us to understand and to recognize, and not cut and run. So, and as I say, there are a lot of additional areas that we could go into and so on, but suffice it to say, today, all I wanted to cover was these three points, and let me summarize them if they kind of got lost in all of my dialogue here. One, I think you're pretty clear on this, we need to be committed to our marriages. We really do need to be committed to our marriages. That's point one. And hopefully, if we're committed to our marriages on the same level that we understand God is committed to our resurrection, because that's what we're talking about. That's the barometer. That's the equation. Then, God willing, in that regard, there isn't anything we can't work through. Fair? Is that a fair statement? I think it's a fair statement. Do you? Secondly, approach our conflicts with mutual respect. That's point two. Don't get defensive. Approach it with mutual respect. I'm okay, he's okay, she's okay, you know. We're equal in this. We've got a difference of opinion. We've got a different perspective. We've got a different take on this. How can we resolve this? Or maybe we can't resolve it. Again, let me emphasize, maybe we can't resolve this. So, how do we manage through it? What compromises do we need to make? What sacrifices do we have to do to manage through this? Divorce? It's not in the vocabulary. That's certainly not socially, in our world today, acceptable, is it? Because it is an option, right? No, not for Christians. In the beginning, it was not so, said Jesus. Remember that? The original intent was, but in the beginning, it was not intended like that. Why did Moses write that? Because of your weaknesses. I see. Point three. Commit to resolving, again, I want to emphasize, commit to resolving or managing through the conflict. Commit to resolving or managing through the conflict. Be committed to our marriages, approach our conflicts with mutual respect, and commit to resolving it and forgetting it, or managing through it somehow. Figuring out what strategy, what action plan, what's necessary to make the compromises and or the sacrifices to deal with the issue. To deal with the issue so that we can get on from here. And hopefully, with God's Spirit, we can work it out, or at least, brethren, manage through it.